This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program exclusively on Aspen Public Radio, where we talk with the musicians, composers, movers, and shakers at the Aspen Music Festival and School. Support for summer classical music programming on Aspen Public Radio is provided by the Barnard Fane Foundation. We have another busy week at the Aspen Music Festival, and we have four interviews today. John Rojak of the American Brass Quintet and a few of his brassy students will be talking up their July 17th concert. Percussionist Jonathan Haas will tip his hand and let us know more about what he plans to play at his July 15th and August 5th concerts. Betsy Schwarm, author of an American music book called A Star-Spangled Survey, talks about a book that is right down the alleyway of the Being American theme of this year's festival. But first, let's talk with Dorothy Gall, who plays Anne Eggerman in the Stephen Sondheim waltz-driven comedy A Little Night Music. Well, Dorothy, we had to pre-record this because obviously on Friday you're going to be right in the middle of performances, but we still have the 13th and the 15th to see A Little Night Music of Stephen Sondheim. And I see from your background here that you've sung a fair amount of opera already. You sang the role of Loretta in Johnny Skeeky. It's a very silly comedy. And right in the middle of it, Loretta, Puccini drops in one of the most beautiful arias he has ever written just for you.
Oh, I know. I feel so spoiled.
Yeah. So I wonder if there's anything like that in the Sondheim, because the Sondheim musical is a comedy, A Little Night Music. But like every good comedy, it kind of wrenches your heart a little bit, and you hate to see people hurting each other that way and all
right.
that. Are there any songs that really stand out for you as places where you really get to emote and express the beauty of song?
Absolutely. So for my character, Anne, she has this beautiful number that turns into a trio. As we know, Sondheim wrote most of the music as a waltz throughout the entire show.
Mm-hmm.
So he loved to play with the number three. So eventually I have my stepson and my husband all singing together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite interesting because we all have different premises, right? So my husband's premise would be that he wants to make love to me. And I'm saying, soon we will. And then my stepson's premise is later. Everyone always tells me later, we'll do things later.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So at this moment, I think it's so interesting to see the convergence of all three characters' identities and how it's so unlikely that all the songs would go together, but the words go together perfectly, and it's kind of madness. So I think it's one of the most powerful moments in the first act for me, absolutely.
I wonder also when it comes to Sondheim, I'm always just amazed at just how much sheer work it must be to bring all the different parts together. It's not like you walk on the stage, you sing an aria, you leave, the next person walks off, sings
mm-hmm.
an aria. You're always bantering back and forth musically.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a lot of drilling to do just to get it right for the rhythm of this?
Oh, nothing at all. Of
no.
course not. No.
<Piece of cake>.
Did you hear the sarcasm? I know you can't see my face, but no, absolutely. There's lots of drilling. So from the very first day, we have a sit down where we read through the entire script.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually we do read through all of the musical words too, so you have a lot of repetition. But it's a lot of creating those personal connections with the other actors on stage, which is really vital
mm-hmm.
for the success of the show. So you have other people that you're trying to interact with, and you never know how they're going to take their line or what sort of inspiration you might have. So we had lots of drilling of lines, lots of exercises to think of things differently, tons of choreography. We have
mm-hmm.
lots of dance calls. I know you'll see if you go to the show, you'll see about a minute of waltzing in the beginning, which actually was quite challenging at this altitude to put together.
Well, singing must be really challenging up here.
Oh, yeah. So the first couple weeks is definitely an adjustment period, kind
mm-hmm.
of retrain the breathing muscles, and you have to get hold of your breath again. And the Wheeler Opera House, we have tons of stairs. I mean, it's just
yes.
full of staircases. So in between each scene, when I have to go stage right to stage left, I'm running under the opera house,
oh my
on
gosh.
Top of the opera house, quick changing, and then boom, you're back on stage. And all the meanwhile, you're trying not to cough up a lung.
Right, exactly. How does this compare for you? I mean, this is musical theater. You obviously are trained as an opera singer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of sopranos, usually you die ignominiously on the stage. And they can, we can look forward to a lot of death ahead.
I know. But, what a life.
but comedy, in many ways, almost everyone says it's harder, for one thing, because
mm-hmm.
of the timing. Because you can always emote, and if you stab yourself, everyone's going to feel horrible, you know. But when it comes to comedy, you can't make everybody laugh quite as easily. What do you see as the challenges of musical theater versus opera and comedy versus the tragedies that you oftentimes are a part of?
Right. So I have to say, first of all, I love not having to die at the end of a show. Right. It's quite refreshing and it kind of rejuvenates me in a way. But actually, that's a great question because I feel like in opera, there are plenty of comedic operas and I've been in plenty of them, but I think it's a little more prescribed. So because of the music and the limitations, you know, pieces and movements and different tempi, you have less freedom in a way of creating your own comedic timing. However, in a musical or a play, all you have is time. You are the one that's driving the boat. So I can choose to wait 5 seconds to say my line if I so choose. There's no orchestra that's going to be running away from me. But also, you have other people to play with. And I think a lot of nuance in the voice. Because in opera, everything I do is based in technique. Firstly, because if the person in the back of the hall cannot hear what I'm doing, you know, what's the point of doing it, right?
Right, right.
But when we have amplification, I can play around a lot more with all of the different colors and different interesting things my voice can do. So I think that's a very important part to creating the comedic effect. And of course, it's scary. You know, you think, oh, no one's going to think I'm funny. But, you know, luckily you have a few chuckles and a few people that take pity on you in rehearsal. And then you gain your courage. And eventually you see what kind of hits and sticks. And, you know, every night's different. Every night you will hear, you'll either hear raucous applause or you'll hear raucous laughter. And some nights it might be a little more, you know, you can hear the bird outside chirping. But, you know, that's how life goes, right? It's not going to all be perfect or what our idea of perfection is.
Now, let's go backwards a little bit because this musical originally began as the Ingmar Bergman movie. It's not set the same way. Can you give me a little bit of an idea and give our audience a little bit of an idea of how it's set slightly differently from the way it was in the Bergman movie?
Sure. So this production is very minimalistic. And we use a lot of bold colors, but we have very traditional costumes, which actually are on rent from the Houston Grand Opera's production. In the beginning, we're all in our under things set a long time ago, so they're not very scandalous or what have you.
Right.
But a lot of the pieces are so beautiful, and some of our costume makers here actually remade some of the costumes for us because we have some height differences in the cast versus the original cast from the Houston Grand Opera. But going back to the stage, I mean, it's very minimalistic. We have bold colors, and then once we go to the countryside, it's all white. So you really have the difference between the dark blue and the whites, and it's a lot of focus for the audience because we don't use a lot of props. So a lot of it is mimed, which is a very interesting approach to the show, which I actually adore because it lets you play with a whole variety of different objects at a time and never feeling too attached to one.
How do you like acting with your boyfriend as opposed to somebody that is just a professional colleague?
Oh, it's delightful. I mean, we can really terrorize each other right on stage. Like, I know at the end of the day, he'll still love me, hopefully.
Right.
So we really can have so many liberties with one another, especially, you know, for romantic scenes, it's a lot more helpful because
it's
more
easy.
Honest.
Right.
Yeah. But also it's just as fun, you know, playing jokes on each other or
getting mad at each other.
Exactly.
Or killing each other.
It's like finally you can express those frustrations or excitements that maybe you wouldn't want to in real life. But it's wonderful. But actually in this show, it's funny because our characters hardly ever cross paths. So he is coupled with another girl. He's coupled with Charlotte, the character, and I'm coupled with Frederick and my stepson, Henrik.
But I thought that you were kind of decoupling and recoupling a lot in this play.
Oh, yes, that's true. But somehow Carl Magnus and I never hit it off. We do get to waltz together in the beginning, so look for us.
Okay. Well, Dorothy, thank you so much. We're looking forward to seeing you over at the Wheeler.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
If you've just joined us, this is Festival Showcase, and we've been chatting with Dorothy Gall, who plays Anne Eggerman in the Stephen Sondheim comedy, A Little Night Music, running July 13th and 15th at the Wheeler Opera House. Now let's talk with percussionist Jonathan Haas, who performs at Harris Hall July 15th and August 5th. Well, Jonathan, as the top dog percussionist at the Aspen Music Festival, you're going to be a busy boy these next couple of weeks, aren't you?
It's going to be fun.
Yeah, no doubt. Let's talk about some of the concerts that are coming up. First of all, there's that chamber music concert on July 15th, and that includes a George Crumb piece that you'll be involved in. Music for a summer evening, how perfect can that be? But tell us a little bit about that piece and why you like that so much.
George Crumb really is the most important composer, American composer, of the 20th and 21st century. And his understanding of percussion in particular was extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
He assigned the percussionist to sing, to play Tibetan prayer stones, to do all sorts of play saws, crazy things.
And this goes back to, like, what, the 60s or 70s when he first began doing that extensively.
Exactly. And his breakthrough piece was Ancient Voices of Children.
Mm-hmm.
And I played that when I was an undergraduate at Washington University in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And from that moment on, I was hooked. And you have to sing and vocalize and whistle, besides playing really hard percussion parts. But it's the beauty of the music is unsurpassed, I think, by any composer. And he understood the depth of inspirational sounds that they could make so organic.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from the beating of a heart, the actual sound of that, to something called the cannon drum that he uses in one of his pieces, in which literally is meant to for the audience to feel as though they just got shot by a cannon.
Well, this sounds, I mean, the title makes me think this one's going to be almost the opposite of that, music for a summer evening, unless that summer evening happens to be July 4th at night. But
well, it has aspects of rainy summer nights and also wonderfully star-studded nights where you look up into the heavens and contemplate your own existence. And I think it embraces a full cycle from the time of dusk until throughout the night, and things that we all dream of and think of and listen in the distance.
Well, speaking of genius, to me, the greatest genius of the entire 20th century possibly was Shostakovich. And I had no idea that the 15th Symphony has been arranged in a way that you're going to be very involved in on July 25th. This is the recital with Colin Curry and other percussionists. And the Shostakovich 15th Symphony was rearranged, including three percussion players and a very small group. But talk to us a little bit about why this particular arrangement works really well for the Shostakovich.
Well, the arrangement is for the listeners, it's for piano, violin, cello, and three percussionists. It's so transparent in the way that it was arranged. It was arranged by the pianist who worked with Shostakovich to make all of the piano arrangements that had to be used for review before allowed public performance.
So the censors had to hear a two piano version, is what you're saying.
Right. And one of the pianists, who obviously was a very close friend of Shostakovich, and one basically had to win Stalin over that this music had all the nationalistic qualities of it, although we know there was a lot of wink, wink, wink and in the music. But in this collaboration, the pianist suggested to Shostakovich this really interesting version with the three percussionists, which is also why it's landing on Colin Curry's recital, Colin Curry being one of the great solo percussionists in the world in modern times. So I did a performance with Stephen Frucht at the Juilliard School. Stephen Frucht is one of the great neurodoctors who works on movement disorder, and he himself is a consummate concert pianist. And as a doctor, he would know something like this, but the end of the symphony ends with this really strange, peculiar sound of the woodblock and a glockenspiel, and a tom-tom and a snare drum and a xylophone. And when you listen to it, it sounds like you were in the ICU unit with all of the medical machinery twirling, swirling around. And sure enough, Dr. Frucht confirmed that this is what Shostakovich had in mind, because when he wrote the piece, this was at the end of his life, and he ended up in a hospital room at the end of his life. Well, what could that possibly be? But it really sounds like the respirator and the drip and all of those things that are in the medical profession. But when put into the context of the symphony, even in this very intimate version, it's really poignant, and it does bring the reflection of where he was at this point in his life, which was the end of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very emotional.
Wow. Well, that's one I don't want to miss. And by the way, if people don't know about this recital, it also features Sergei Kachatryan and Elisa Weilerstein's playing the cello. Enon Barnaton is playing the piano. I mean, this is an incredible concert that I think that people should make a point of going to see, because not only the great artists that are there, but then an arrangement of a Shostakovich piece that some of us know, but I have never even heard of this arrangement before. And then the final one that that I see on the program here that's really major that you'll be preparing for is the percussion ensemble recital on August 5th, and that is always one of the trippier performances that happens in the entire season.
Well, we promise not to disappoint.
What do you have, like 200 instruments or 150 different instruments? Well,
I think 200 is a modest number, and we'll take
highly reasonable.
We'll take that one.
Mm-hmm.
So we have Wernin Quartet, a piece by Julie Wolf called Dark Full Ride, which for the drum set lovers, this one is spectacular. So we're going to do a violin concerto for percussion, orchestra, and violin that'll feature Jennifer Coe. And then on the second half, we're going to do the Ballet Mécanique by George Antile, which, if the listeners don't know, caused a riot at Carnegie Hall upon its premiere.
Riots at musical premieres seem to be a good omen for their long-term recognition, like I think Rite of Spring and other pieces like that.
Exactly.
So that's good. That's a badge of honor. I hope someday I write a piece that causes a riot.
Let me know. I'll stay away.
Okay. You've always been a person that impresses me as being just really supportive of the students, of your fellow faculty members. I just want to ask a little bit about that, because in an environment with this many musicians, with this many musical egos, I know sometimes that can be a real challenge, because you have done it very successfully.
Well, I appreciate that. I feel, and I think that many of my colleagues feel, that it's really an honor to be able to spend your life in the arts as a musician, doing what we're doing. Now, I can be just as curmudgeon as anybody, so that's not a problem. And being at the festival, our job is to inspire young people. I don't know if there's a better job in the world than that, to mm-hmm, be able to mm-hmm. be with them. They keep you young. They keep you really honest.
Right.
And they keep you on your toes. So mm-hmm. just a wonderful experience for students, for ourselves, and in the most glorious place in the world, Aspen, Colorado. Doesn't get any better than this.
That's right. I agree. That's why I come up here every year. Jonathan, thanks so much. Looking forward to talking to you again in maybe a couple of years. And catching up again with what you've got in the percussion department.
Always thank you for having me. I enjoy it.
We've been talking with percussionist Jonathan Haas, who performs at Harris Hall July 15th and August 5th. And speaking of high-volume music, let's talk next with John Rojak of the American Brass Quintet and some of his students about their July 17th concert and Music on the Mountain. John, I see you've brought several other musicians in here. I guess they're probably not string players, would be my first guess.
I actually have many friends who are string players.
They're nice people.
They're tolerable, but I brought some of the best people.
I see.
Which are some of our American Brass Quintet Seminar at Aspen Seminar students.
Mm-hmm. Are all of you in a brass quintet?
Right, yeah, we all came here in preformed brass quintets. I am in a group called 511 Brass. We are from New York City. We were formed at the Juilliard School. And these people are from very different places.
Yeah, so my quintet was preformed in Los Angeles, and we're a group that's all undergraduate students from UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
My quintet is formed in Singapore. We are from Yongsu Do Conservatory of Music. But actually, none of us is from Singapore. Well, I'm from Chile.
I
and
see.
And my other members are from Thailand, Vietnam, and Taiwan.
Oh, my goodness. So I have to ask, when it comes to brass quintet music, of course it's from the European tradition, but are there a lot of people from Asia and others composing for brass quintet now? You may even know about that.
Yeah, yes, definitely. There are so many new composers, young composers, mm-hmm. and who really love to write for brass.
Now, I'm going to bring John back into the picture here as the teacher. I remember last year you had, oh my goodness, you would know, you might even know the exact count, but it was a few
25.
Dozen. 25. Okay, I was going to guess a couple dozen, so I wasn't too far
yes.
off. You had 25 brass players kind of in a semicircle on the stage at Harris Hall, which was one of the most magnificent sounds. My ears were ringing a little bit at the end, but it was an incredible sound. Are you planning on doing something similar to that in your American Brass Quintet concert that's coming up?
The multiple brass players on stage at Harris Hall apparently was so successful that all of us in ABQ have heard from a lot of the people around Aspen asking if we're going to replicate that, so I think we have to.
By popular demand.
Yes. And I implored all the brass players to cool it until the last four measures of the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I said it was okay to blow the roof off.
Tell us about your July 17th concert then with the American Brass Quintet, and then we'll get back to some of the students too.
We decided to take this year's theme of the Aspen Music Festival seriously,
mm-hmm.
being American, since about 90% of our music that we've acquired and commissioned over the last 60 years. Most of our music is American. We didn't think it would be a stretch to wind up with an all-American program.
Mm-hmm.
We're starting with a piece that was commissioned by Juilliard for us by Joan Tower with Joan Tower's Copper Wave.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really great piece. We've played it dozens and dozens of times. We're going to play our first performance of a piece by another woman composer, Jessica Meyer. New piece for us, which is terrific. And then we have two pieces that are kind of as close to rock and roll as classical brass quintets can come. And then another piece by Trevor Gorekis called Fixated Nights,
mm-hmm.
which Trevor Gorekis was an assistant to Philip Glass. And the piece is a little bit quirky and really kind of gets in a groove and has some jazzy elements to it. You also notice, I mentioned the titles, Fixated Nights. Jessica Meyer's piece is called Luminosity. We have Copper Wave and Reflecting Light. So they all, we think there's a thread through there with some sort of light motif, so to speak.
A light motif, okay.
Yes.
I get it.
What I might mention, this is the second summer of the Advanced Chamber Music Program.
So let me switch over back over to the students now, if I may. Are any of you playing either trombone or tuba, for starters? Do we have a tuba player here?
I play tuba.
You play tuba.
I play trombone.
Okay. You play trombone. Okay,
yes.
So also, since you're playing the tuba, I know when I've been taught to about composition myself, that they warn me, any whether it be a string bass or a tuba or whatever, that they can't really play very fast.
I think especially when it comes to new compositions, there's a lot more room for the tuba and especially other lower instruments to, you know, do a little bit more musical acrobatics.
Mm-hmm.
I think that like slow stereotype definitely comes from like 18th, 19th century orchestral pieces.
Okay. And then you're a trumpeter.
I'm a trumpet player. I am outnumbered in this room.
Right. But you still get to play the top melody. You know, in the very old traditions, the trumpet was associated with like the Archangel Gabriel or the heavens opening up.
Exactly. The trumpet
things.
Is mentioned in the Bible about seven times. It's
right.
The only instrument. I don't see tuba in there. No. No, I'm just kidding.
You heathens.
Yeah.
Every one of you. Can any of you recall interesting stories? Because I can imagine that brass quintets, probably the people who are part of brass quintets have somewhat different personalities perhaps than string quartets. I might be wrong, but knowing John Rojak as well as I do over the years, I would have to say there's a certain sense of irony or sarcasm or wit. would you like to share any stories about your camaraderie with your fellow musicians in your quartets, or quintets rather?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great thing. Our quintet is very diverse. Our other trumpet player plays in big bands when he's in New York City. Our bass trombone player is really big in the orchestra, and he just played a film not too long ago. Our horn player makes drones in his free time, and I love writing film music, and so there's a lot of different personalities, like you said.
Well, let's kind of wrap it up by kind of going back to the concerts themselves. We have one on July 17th featuring the American Brass Quintet, And then all you other quintets are being featured on the 19th, which I look forward to. That's at 8:30, I think, on the 19th, right?
It is. I believe both concerts are at 8:30.
So what is this blowout piece that you can open it up for us and tell us what it is, what you've got lined up?
Yes. Going back to the theme, being American, we were looking for a brass ensemble finale that would work well. And we have some brass band music mm-hmm. from the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to play it on our modern instruments. We're going to play a set of 5 or 6 brass band pieces and incorporate all the students into that, and hopefully it'll be a rousing finale.
Mm-hmm.
The students' concert on Friday, I think, should be fantastic. Each of our 6 groups will play one of the real significant works that they've been working on.
It is. It's wonderful to hear these instruments. And by the way, if any of you have not heard the American Brass Quintet in Harris Hall, it has great acoustics for string quartets and for baroque ensembles and things like that. It's actually very good for anything. But wow, does brass ever! You must just love playing in that hall.
We do. We've even recorded a couple of CDs in there.
Yes. So, John, thank you, and thank you to all the different brass quintets that are being represented here. Have a great time the rest of this summer. Hike safe, and I look forward to seeing you at the concerts.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
We just heard from John Rojak of the American Brass Quintet and some of his students about their July 17th concert and Music on the Mountain. Now let's hear briefly from author and classical music historian Betsy Schwarm about her new book about American music. Music historian Betsy Schwarm is not directly involved with the Aspen Music Festival and school, but the book that she just wrote, Classical Music Insights, A Star-Spangled Survey, is all about American composers, and it's over 400 pages, and it's fascinating. Betsy, thank you for coming into the studio.
Thank you for the invitation, Chris.
I wanted to ask, now I know you've done others on Mozart and kind of Bach and the Baroque, and you've done one on Beethoven. This, I think, was a coincidence, because it takes a while to write a book. It's not like you said, oh, I'm going to write this because Aspen's doing this.
In fact, I was pleasantly surprised to see that Aspen was doing an American focus. I decided to do this one when it occurred to me, looking over my previous books, that I haven't touched American music at all in some time. Also, mm-hmm. it was 2016, the election year, when there was a lot of chatter about immigrants, who cares about immigrants, let's be American. And I thought, well, A, we do care about immigrants, and B, what does it mean to be an American? And the theme of the book is, how do these different composers express Americanness in their music? And there's a whole chapter about the ones who weren't born here, but are still having a huge influence upon American music.
And speaking of that, too, and American composers, we have a lot of those here in Aspen, and we have had a lot over the decades at the Aspen Music Festival and School. Can you think of a few names that are in your book that you talk about?
I can name for you, in fact, one very specific piece that had its American premiere here at Aspen, because Aspen co-commissioned it. In the chapter on minimalism, the section that has Philip Glass and John Adams, one of the Philip Glass articles is his second violin concerto that he wrote for Robert McDuffie, who gave its American premiere here. It's a Four Seasons concerto. And I spoke with Robert McDuffie about it quite some time ago, and he told me, you know, Philip and I don't agree as to which movement is which season. We also have Mohammed Fairouz, the Arab-American composer who was in residence here, I believe it was last summer, maybe it was the summer before.
Mm-hmm.
Mark O'Connor is in here.
Can you tell us, I haven't had time to read the entire book, I have to admit, but I've opened it up at random, and it's been fascinating. I mean, one time I opened it up to find out that Pachelbel's son was the first known American composer. One time I opened it up and found out that Amy Beach was as brilliant a child prodigy as Mozart. Can you tell us any other interesting stories or funny stories that you might have in this book that people might not know about American composers whose names they do recognize?
How about Charles Ives?
We can try that.
The most success that Charles Ives had during his years of study at Yale were as a pitcher for the school's baseball team.
Well, Betsy Schwarm's book is called Classical Music Insights, A Star-Spangled Survey. I know it's available on Amazon and perhaps in some bookstores, but again, I'd suggest you might want to consider picking it up if you're interested in learning more about American music. Betsy, thank you for coming in.
You're very welcome, Chris. Thanks for the invitation.
We've been talking with author and classical music historian Betsy Schwarm about her new book about American music, Classical Music Insights, A Star-Spangled Survey, available on Amazon and in some local bookstores. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program exclusively on Aspen Public Radio, where we talk with the musicians, composers, movers, and shakers at the Aspen Music Festival and School. I'm Chris Moore. Support for summer classical music programming on Aspen Public Radio is provided by the Barnard Fane Foundation. You can listen to previous interviews on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale.